Louise, he spoke at last, I am not doing this for Munger. Even a friendship cannot condone deliberate robbery and premeditated murder. She did not reply. Many times you must have seen the way I have looked at you. For God knows I could not help myself. Still she was silent. You did know, he insisted. You, as a woman, must know how I feel. Yes, she said at last. When I thought you were married to a friend, it was hopeless. Now at least I can tell you how I feel. Zuga, please don't. I would do anything you asked me to, even protect a murderer. That is how I feel for you. Zuga, I have never known anybody so beautiful and bright and brave. I am not any of those things. I could put you and Mungo on the road to Kuramun, and then go back to Kimberley and tell the Diamond Police where to find you. They would take Mungo, and then you would be free. You could, she agreed, but you never would. Both of us are tied, Zuga, by our own peculiar sense of duty and of honour. Louise, we have arrived, she said with patent relief. The crossroads. Turn off the road here. From the bench, she guided him as he threaded the cart through the scattered bush, and the high wheels bumped over rock and rough ground. A quarter of a mile from the road, there stood a massive camel-thorn tree, silver and high as a hill in the moonlight. Beneath its spread branches, the moon's shadow was black and impenetrable. From the darkness, a hoarse voice challenged, "Stand where you are. Don't come any closer." "Mungo, it's me, and Zuga is with me." Louise jumped down from the cart, lifted the lantern off its bracket, and went forward, stooping under the branches. Zuga tethered the mules and then followed her. Louise was kneeling beside Mungo St. John. He lay on a saddle blanket, propped on the silver ornamented Mexican saddle. "Thank you for coming," he greeted Zuga, and his voice was ragged with pain. "How badly are you hit?"
"Badly enough," he admitted. "Do you have a cheroot?"
Zuga lit one from the lantern and handed it to him. Louise was unwrapping the torn strips of shirt and petticoat that were bound about his chest. "Shotgun?" Zuga asked tersely.
"No, thank God," Mungo said. "Pistol."
"You are lucky," Zuga grunted. "Nyman's usual style is a sawed-off shotgun. He would have blown you in half."
"You know him, Nyman?"
"He's a police trap."
"Police?"
Mungo whispered.
"Oh, God!"
"Yes," Zuga nodded. "You are in trouble."
"I didn't know."
"Does it really matter?" Zuga asked. "You planned an IDB switch, and you knew you might have to kill a man."
"Don't preach to me, Zuga."
"All right." Zuga squatted next to Louise as she exposed the wound in Mungo's back. "And it looks as though it missed the bloody lymph, set in a livid spread of bruise." Between them they lifted Mungo into a sitting position. "Through and through," Zuga murmured, as he saw the exit wound in Mungo's back. "And it looks as though it missed the lung, too. You are luckier than you'll ever know."
"One stayed in,"
Mungo St. John contradicted him, and reached down to his own leg. His breeches had been split down the leg, and now he pulled the blood-stained cloth aside to reveal a strip of pale thigh, in the centre of which was another vicious little round opening from which fluid wept like blackcurrant juice.
"The bullet is still in," Mungo repeated.
"Bone?" Zuga asked.
"No," St. John shook his head. "I don't think so. I was still able to walk on it."
"Well, there's no chance of trying to cut the bullet out. Louise knows where she can find a doctor, and I have told her how to get there."
"Louise?"
Mungo asked with a sardonic twist of his lips. She did not look up, concentrating on the task of painting the skin around the wounds with iodine. Mungo was staring at Zuga, his single eye gleaming, and Zuga felt the scar on his cheek throb, and he did not trouble to hide his anger. "You don't think I'm doing this for you?" he demanded. "I hate IDB as much as any digger on the workings.
and I'm not that complacent about deliberate robbery and murder. And he took the pistol from the blanket where it lay at Mungo's side. He checked the load as he walked to where Shooting Star stood, head down in the moonlight beyond the camelthorn tree. The stallion lifted his head and blew a fluttery breath through his nostrils as Zuger approached. Then he shifted his weight awkwardly and painfully on three legs. "There, boy. Easy, boy." Zuger ran his hands down the animal's flank. It was sticky with drying blood, and Shooting Star wickered as he touched the wound. Behind the ribs, bullet hole, and Zuger sniffed at it quickly. The bullet had pierced the bowel or the intestines. He could smell it. Zuger went down on one knee and gently felt the foreleg that the stallion was favouring. He found the damage. Another bullet wound. It had struck a few inches above the fetlock, and the bone was shattered. Yet the horse had carried Mungo, a big, heavy man, and it had brought him many miles. The agony must have been dreadful, but the stallion's great heart had carried them through. Zuger shrugged off his greatcoat and wrapped it around the pistol in his right hand. A shot could alert the searching bands on the not-too-distant road. "There, boy," Zuger whispered, and touched the muzzle to the forehead between the horse's eyes. The cloth muffled the shot. It was a dull blurt of sound, and the stallion dropped heavily on his side and never even kicked. Louise was still bowed over Mungo, tying the knots in the bandage, but Zuger saw that her eyes were bright with tears in the moonlight. "Thank you," she whispered. "I couldn't have done it myself." Zuger helped her lift Mungo to the cart. Mungo's breath whistled in his chest, and the sweat of agony drenched his shirt and smelled rancid and gamey. They settled him into the nest of thatching grass and spread a screen of it over him. Then Zuger led the mules on over the felt until they struck the track that led northwards towards the Fal River, and beyond it Kuruman and the vast Kalahari Desert. "Travel at night and hobble the mules to graze during the day," Zuger told her. "There is more than enough meal and biltong, but you will have to spare the coffee and sugar." "Words cannot thank you enough," she whispered. "Don't attempt the main drift of the Fal. Somehow, I know that this is not goodbye." She seemed not to have heard the advice. "And when we meet again," she broke off. "Go on," he said. But she shook her head and took the reins from his hand and led the mules onto the track. The cart seemed to merge into the night, and the wheels made no sound in the thick, pale sand. Zuger stood staring after them long after they had disappeared. And then Louise came back. She came silent as a wraith, running with a kind of terrible desperation. The long tresses of her hair had fallen out from under the cap and were streaming down her back. Her face was pale and stricken in the moonlight. The grip of her arms about his neck was fierce, almost painful, and her mouth was shockingly hot and wet as it spread over his. But the taste of it he would never forget, and her sharp white teeth crushed his lips. For seconds only they clung to each other, while Zuger thought his heart would burst. Then she tore herself from his arms, and with neither a word nor a backward glance, she flew into the night and was gone. 10 days after Neville Pickering's funeral, Zuger signed the transfer deeds to the Devil's Own claims and watched while one of Rhodes's secretaries registered them in favour of the Central Diamond Company. Then he walked out into the cold. For the first time in living memory, it was snowing over the diamond fields. Big soft flakes came twisting down like feathers from a shimmering white egret struck by birdshot. The snowflakes vanished as they touched the earth, but the cold was a vindictive presence, and Zuger's breath steamed in the air and condensed on his beard as he trudged up to the workings to watch the shift come off the Devil's Own claims for the last time. As he walked, he tried to compose the words to tell Ralph that this was his last shift. They were coming up in the skip. Zuger could make out Ralph, for he was the only man who wore a coat,
The other men with him were almost naked. Once again, Zugo wondered idly that the men had not rebelled against the harsh measures of the new Diamond Trade Act, enforced by Colonel John Fry of the recently recruited Diamond Police, and aimed at stamping out IDB on the fields. Nowadays, the black workers were compounded behind barbed wire. There were new curfew regulations to keep them in the compounds after nightfall, and there were spot searches and checks of the compounds, of men on the streets even during daylight, and body searches of each shift coming out of the pit. Even the diggers, or at least a few of them, had protested at the most draconian of John Fry's new regulations. All black workers had been forced to go into the pit stark naked, so that they would not be able to hide stones in their clothing. John Fry had been amazed when Zuga and a dozen other diggers had demanded to see him. "Good Lord, Ballantyne, but they're a bunch of naked savages anyway. Modesty, forsooth." In the end, with the cooperation of Rhodes, they had forced him to compromise. Grudgingly, Fry had allowed every worker a strip of seamless cotton limbo to cover himself. Thus, Butso and his Matabele wore only a strip of loincloth each as they rode up beside Ralph in the skip. The wind threw an icy noose about them, and Butso shivered as goosebumps rose upon the smooth, dark skin of his chest and upper arms. Above him stood Ralph Ballantyne, balancing easily on the rim of the steel skip, ignoring the wind and the deadly drop below him. Ralph glanced down at Butso, crouching below the side of the steel bucket, and on impulse slipped the scrap of stained canvas off his own shoulders. Under it, Ralph wore an old tweed jacket and dusty cardigan. He dropped the canvas over Butso's neck. "It is against the white man's law," Butso demurred, and made as if to shrug it off. "There are no police in this skip," Ralph grunted, and Butso hesitated a moment, and then crouched lower and gratefully pulled the canvas over his head and shoulders. Ralph took the butt of a half-smoked cheroot from his breast pocket and carefully reshaped it between his fingers. The dead ash flaked away on the wind and wafted down into the yawning depths below. He lit the butt and drew the smoke down deeply, exhaled and drew again, held the smoke and passed the butt to Butso. "You are not only cold, but you are unhappy," Ralph said, and Butso did not answer. He cupped the stubby cheroot in both hands and drew carefully upon it. "Is it Don Sella?" Ralph asked. "He knew the law, Butso. He knows what the law says of those who steal the stones."
"It was a small stone," murmured Butso.
The words and blue smoke mingled on his lips.
"And 15 years is a long time."
"He's alive," Ralph pointed out, and took the cheroot that Butso passed back to him. "In the old days before the Diamond Trade Act, he'd be dead by now."
"He might as well be dead," Butso whispered bitterly. "They say that men work like animals, chained like monkeys, on the breakwater wall at Cape Town Harbour."
He drew again on the cheroot, and it burned down with a fierce little glow that scorched his fingers. He crushed it out on the work-hardened calluses of his palm, and let the shreds of tobacco blow away.
"And you, Henshaw, are you then so happy?" he asked quietly,
and Ralph shrugged. "Happy? Who's happy?"
"Is not this pit?"
With a gesture, Butso took in the mighty excavation over which they dangled.
"Is not this your prison? Does it not hold you as surely as the chains that hold Don Sella as he places the rocks on the breakwater over the sea?"
They had almost reached the high stagings, and Butso slipped off his canvas covering before he could be spotted by one of the black constables who patrolled the area inside the new security fences. "You ask me if I am unhappy?" Butso stood up and did not look at Ralph's face.
"I was thinking of the land in which I am a prince of the House of Kumalo. In that land the calves I tended as a boy have grown into bulls and have bred calves which I have never seen. Once I knew every beast in my father's herds, 15,000 head of prime cattle, and I knew each of them, the season of its birth, the twist of its horns, and the markings of its hide. Butzo sighed and came to stand beside Ralph on the rim of the skip. They were of a height, two tall young men, well formed, and each in the manner of his race, comely. 10 times I have not been with my impi when it danced the festival of fresh fruits. 10 times I did not witness my king throw the war spear and send us out on the red road.
Butzo's somber mood deepened, and his voice sank lower.
Boys have grown to men since I left, and some of them wear the cowtails of valor upon their legs and arms.
Butzo glanced down at his own naked body, with its single dirty rag at the waist.
Little girls have grown into maidens, with ripe bellies, ready to be claimed by the warriors, who have won the honour on the red road of war.
And both of them thought of the lonely nights when the phantoms came to haunt them. Then Butzo folded his arms across his wide chest and went on.
I think of my father, and I wonder if the snows of age have yet settled upon his head. Every man of my tribe that comes down the road from the north brings me words of Juba the dove, who is my mother. She has 12 sons, but I am the first and the eldest of them.
Why have you stayed so long? Ralph asked harshly.
Why have you stayed so long, Henshaw?
The young Matabele challenged him quietly, and Ralph had no answer.
Have you found fame and riches in this hole?
Again they both glanced down into the pit, and from this height the offshift waiting to come up in the skips was like columns of safari ants.
Do you have a woman with hair as long and pale as the winter grass to give you comfort in the night, Henshaw? Do you have the music of your son's laughter to cheer you, Henshaw? What keeps you here?
Ralph lifted his eyes and stared at Butzo. But before he could find an answer, the skip came level with the platform on the first ramp of the stagings. The jerk brought Ralph back to reality, and he waved to his father on the platform above them. The roar of the steam winch subsided. The skip slowed, and Butzo led the party of Matabele workers onto the ramp. Ralph saw them all clear before he jumped across the narrow gap to the wooden platform and felt it tremble under the combined weight of 20 men. Ralph signalled again. Then the winch growled, and the steel cable squealed in its sheaves. The heavy-laden skip ran on until it hit the striker blocks. Ralph and Butzo drove the jumper bars back under it and threw their full weight onto them. The skip tipped over, and the load of gravel went roaring down the chute into the waiting cart. Ralph looked up to see his father's encouraging smile, and to hear his shouted congratulations.
Well done, boy! 200 tons today!
But the staging was deserted. Zuga had gone. Zuga had packed a single chest, the chest that had belonged to Aletta, and which had come up with her from the Cape. Now it was going back. And it was almost all that was going back. Zuga put Aletta's Bible in the bottom of the chest, and with it her diary and the trinket box which contained the remaining pieces of her jewellery. The more valuable pieces had long ago been sold to support the dying dream. Over these few mementos he packed his own diaries and maps and his books. When he came to the bundled pile of his unfinished manuscript, he paused to weigh it in his hand. "Perhaps I shall find time to finish it now," he murmured, and laid it gently in the chest. On top of that went his clothing, and there was so little of that. 4 shirts, a spare pair of boots, barely an armful. The chest was only half full, and he carried it easily down the steps into the yard. That was all that he was taking. The rest of it, the meagre furnishings of the bungalow he had sold to one of the auctioneers in Market Square, £10 the lot. As Rhodes had predicted, he was leaving as he had come. "Where is Ralph?" he demanded of Jan Cheroot, and the little Hottentot paused in chaining the cooking pot and black iron kettle onto the tailboard of the cart.
Perhaps he stopped at Diamond Lil's. The boy's got a right to his thirst. He worked hard enough for it.